Hello to everyone out there listening, and welcome to the first season of our brand new Create podcast. Over the next few weeks, we're going to be exploring the world of the creative industries, the fastest growing industry in the UK today. We're going to be chatting to people within the industry, routes they took to where they are today, and how our education system can keep up with this rapidly growing market. Over the course of the next few weeks, we're going to be speaking with people worldwide and try to see what other countries are doing to achieve the same goal. But before we begin, we would like to pay a special thanks to our sponsors, Firstport, for making all of this possible. We look forward to working together over the coming weeks ahead. Welcome to the Create Podcast. Hello, everyone, and welcome to yet another episode of the Create Podcast, the podcast which aims to promote creativity for listeners young and old by speaking with successful examples and the routes they took to where they got to today. The feedback so far from the last few weeks has been absolutely overwhelming. So thank you to everyone who has sent us emails or tweeted about us or put messages on Facebook or Instagram or got in touch with our website. There are so many ways to get in touch now, and we have seen and heard from each of them. So thank you so much to everyone who's listened, shared an episode in the past, and as I said, gotten in touch. It really does mean a huge amount. To date, we've launched a pilot outlining exactly who Brought Talent are and the work that we typically do outside of lockdown periods. We've chatted with film director Doug King in episode 1, Bell and Sebastian singer-songwriter Stuart Murdoch in episode 2, country singer Nathan Carter in episode 3, and today we're delving into the world of comedy, and we're talking with multi-award winning British comedian Josie Long. And I am really, really, really excited for you to hear this. Josie is absolutely brilliant. She's hilarious. She's hardworking. She has done a huge amount of good work, which we're going to be talking all about in the next few minutes. One of the awards that she has won throughout her career, one of the many awards, was the Best Newcomer in 2006 at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival. Now, the reason I'm highlighting that one is because the Edinburgh Fringe Festival has played a massive role in not just Josie's career, but in so many artists' careers, not just from Britain, but artists from around the world that visit the Edinburgh Fringe Festival, which is the largest arts festival in the world, right here on our doorstep in Scotland. So Edinburgh has played a huge role in Josie's career, and Josie has been brilliant for Edinburgh in return in subsequent years as well. So when talking about creativity here in Scotland, we can't overlook what we have on our doorstep in the Edinburgh Fringe Festival. Before we chat with Josie, it seems appropriate to focus on that festival for a few minutes. And in order to help me do that, we have Alan Gordon, the registration manager within the Edinburgh Fringe Festival, has agreed to join the Create Podcast for a few minutes just to give us a brief insight into what happens every year during the Edinburgh Fringe Festival. So Alan, thanks a million for taking the time out to have a chat with us here on the Create Podcast. It's very good of you to join us.
Pleasure to be here.
I know, especially for the week that's in it with the second lockdown being announced, I think we're going to be getting used to chatting to people from our kitchens more often. But I suppose what we're hoping at this section of the episode here, before we chat with Josie, is to give some of the listeners a bit of an understanding of how big the Edinburgh Fringe is. I mean, everyone, I'm sure, has heard of the Edinburgh Fringe Festival. Admittedly, I didn't understand until moving over to Scotland. Again, it was something I heard about growing up and I knew it was a big event. But until you're really witnessing it firsthand, I don't think you can fully grasp just how massive the whole thing is. So is there any chance that you could give us a little bit of a brief and a profile of what the Edinburgh Fringe is all about?
Yeah, sure. First off, I agree with you. Like, I lived in Edinburgh for many years and got the scale of it from someone who was living in the city alongside it. And then I worked for it and learned more about it. And then I did my own shows there and learned what it's like as an artist performing at the Fringe. And it's just such a organic, like ever-changing thing that I think you're right. Until you experience it, you don't really get the full scale and volume of it. For the super brief history, so it kicked off, it all started in 1947. literally the same year as the Edinburgh International Festival, because eight companies didn't get invited to be a part of the first Edinburgh International Festival that was meant to bring people together following the Second World War. And they decided they would just do their shows anyway. And the ethos of that, the, do you know what, anyone can do it, anyone can come, as long as you've got a story to tell, that's what remains unchanging to this very day. Like, so as much as what a lot of people talk about as being like the biggest of all the festivals out there, the thing that I really would drill home to people is the fact that we're the largest open access arts festival in the world, which basically means there's no one that curates the fringe. There's no one who runs the fringe or controls it in any way. I work for the Fringe Society, which we're the charity that, I guess we're kind of the custodians. We support the running of it. But the Fringe, essentially, anyone who's got a story to tell and a venue to tell it in can do that. And we're the people who are in charge of just making sure it remains as open and uncensored as possible.
One of the statistics that I heard about the Edinburgh Fringe was that it places third in the world for ticketed events behind the Olympics and the World Cup. I mean, is that a true statistic or
that is a true statistic. The only thing I would question is, I think at one point we went into second.
No way.
I think
over the World Cup or the Olympics?
I think us in the World Cup are neck and neck.
We trade places
a lot. So I think the Olympics has us beat, but apart from that, like, we're up there with the world. So yeah, for ticketed events, we're definitely top three.
So, I mean, for something to give that you know, the context of just how the sheer volume of all of this, what's the prep like then in the run-up to putting something like this on? I mean, when does the prep start? Is it the second 1 year is over, you're straight on to planning the next year?
Yeah, so I guess, like, in the society itself, maybe not this year so much. The normal run of order is shuffled around a little. But yeah, normally there's, like, you kind of pass the baton in terms of our team. So, like, our marketing and development teams are already kind of working on next year as soon as we're rounding up the year that's been. So there's a whole big process. Like, in my job, I kind of lead on the printed program and the show registration process. So, like, I'm kind of recruiting my team in November, December time. So as we open registration in January, it's not just turning up in August.
I can imagine.
We have our own podcast series called Fringecasts.
Brilliant. I was going to say, is there anything that people can keep an eye on or tune into?
You can. There's been a bit of a gap with them as we recalibrated for 2020. But there's if you head to the Ed Fringe YouTube channel, there's a whole playlist of, like, our
back
catalogue of episodes. The thing I loved about that is every day you'd just be sitting down talking to people about their shows and people are incredibly passionate about them, and it's just sort of getting a little bit of an insight into someone's world. So
yeah, of course. And I'd say not only do you get a huge amount of passion, but a huge amount of variety as well. Because, I mean, it literally every type of the arts is prevalent in the Edinburgh Fringe. It's amazing.
Oh, huge. Like, you're sitting talking to, like, a group of puppeteers from China, and then and you've got a stand-up from Bristol.
It's amazing.
Some are in big venues where they're charging like £20 a ticket, and some are on a free fringe model in the back room of a pub, and they're both equally as valid. It's great.
Brilliant. Well, I mean, Alan, I really appreciate you taking the time out to join us in the podcast and just to give the listeners a little bit of an insight, because, as I said, it is something, if you haven't seen or visited Edinburgh during the Fringe Festival, it should be on the bucket list. For all the work that you guys do, thank you very much. I know, I'm sure this is a tricky period for everyone involved, but you know, I know I speak for a lot of people when I say I can't wait for all of this to be over and for Edinburgh to be back doing what it does best.
And I think what's important this year, like, when there's been a bit of a pause, is we've had a real chance to look at our work we do, like, with schools and with communities to try and, like, because actually we have that responsibility as a society. As much as I work in the team that is very much focused on the artist and the participant and the performer, we have, like, whole teams of people who look after, like, our engagement with the communities of Edinburgh and schools. So as we're really dedicated to making sure, like, Edinburgh feels like it's a festival for them as much as a festival for the whole world.
Brilliant. Well, Alan, thank you so much for taking the time out, and I really appreciate you stopping into the Create Festival to give us a bit of an insight to what the Edinburgh Fringe Festival is all about, the largest arts festival in the world, which is amazing. And it being the episode about Josie and the success she's had at Edinburgh in particular throughout the years, it seemed fitting to have a mention about the Fringe Festival. So thanks a million for stopping in to tell us all about it.
Perfect. Keen to listen to Josie because she's a bit of a fringe legend. Like, she's one of those people I've seen year on year. And like, even when she got bigger, she still wants to be like in a cave with 50 seats.
Brilliant. Brilliant. Well, listen, Alan, you're a star. Thanks so much.
No worries. Lovely meeting you.
Our guest today is British comedian and actor Josie Long. Josie has toured for years as a stand-up comedian, written for both radio and TV, and is featured on various celebrity shows such as Celebrity MasterChef and Celebrity Island with Bear Grylls. It was an absolute pleasure to chat with Josie about her rise to success and the steps she took to get there, as well as the charity she set up called Arts Emergency. We couldn't be any more excited to welcome Josie Long to the Create Podcast. But yeah, Josie, listen, thank you so much for taking the time out and for joining the Create Podcast. It's absolutely brilliant having you on board.
Thanks, Liz, for having me. I'm really excited.
Not at all. This is the first time that I've obviously met you, but I've heard a huge amount about you already from working with Darren and Doug as well in the various projects. So I've heard about the famous Josie Long for a long time now. So it's great to be able to chat virtually at the minute. But how have the last few months been before we dive into things?
It's so hard, isn't it? It's hard to talk about it because you sort of go, it's just so big. It's everything, everything. So, I mean, there's been periods when I really have felt like I've been ticking along and making the best of it. And I grew, for example, from seed, a cucumber, an entire cucumber.
Oh, did you?
One, a bit disappointing, but I grew it. I picked it. I ate like one bite. My daughter ate the whole thing in like 10 seconds. It was a beautiful experience. But at the same time, also, like, you know, it's very, very hard to like adjust to the fact that since I was a teenager, I've been doing stand-up. It's how I live my life. And yeah, I'm doing it online and I did the odd little gig while I could in the window when they opened up again, but it's not the same. It's not the same.
I was going to ask you, I mean, from like during your online stuff now that you're doing, are you able to get any response from people?
It's quite a mixed bag. Like what's been really interesting is, so in the comedy industry, people have reacted to lockdown in so many diverse and interesting ways. So some people, there's a guy called Stuart Goldsmith who's been running Zoom gigs where he's got a really nicely curated audience that you can see and hear, and they talk to you and it's genuinely a lovely experience. And then other gigs you do, I've done some gigs that are sort of nominally corporate gigs where they're kind of a private Zoom for a company.
Yeah.
Oh, that's hard work. That is incredible hard work. You have people who are literally, they'll see your face, come on, and you see them, but they don't realise that you can see them, and they're literally like, and they're like, walk out the Zoom frame. Absolute brutal. And then
because my worst nightmare would be that, almost what happened there, that you'd think that someone was interrupting you and you'd stop in your flow to listen to them, or there'd be a delay in the chat with Wi-Fi. I mean, there must be so many additional stresses and worries to consider.
Yeah, so I do stuff on Twitch. I was performing my show for most of the summer, just partly because I've been touring a show and that tour got cut short by about 3 months. And I just didn't want to stop performing the show because I knew I'd forget it. And so I was performing that a lot on Twitch, kind of 2-3 times a week. And when I was doing it, you have this chat window and I would, A, be so desperate for people to write like, ha, 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 in the chat and be like, oh, my God, oh, people are laughing. But also there would always be a delay. So it was really hard to follow. And sometimes people would show up to every single show. It's the same show. They would watch me performing the same show and just like chat in the chat. Like it was there.
Is there a little social?
Yeah. And it was so distracting because I was like, why are you talking about another comedian in my chat for no reason during a show? I was like, oh. So yeah, it was tricky.
Myself and my wife, Laura, who we got a gig together throughout the year, and we've been doing shows online on a website, stage it. And again, like that, it's great in the sense that we're able to gig in some capacity at the minute, you know, which is just, you miss that performance big time. But what I really, as you're talking about it there, I totally empathize with, because it's not up until really halfway through the first song when the comments start coming through saying, oh, sounds great, or whatever. I start a gig and I'm so nervous. I'm just like, you know, there could be Wi-Fi connection. There could be so many things that are going wrong and you've no idea. You're standing there with the guitar just trying to pretend like it's all going well.
Yes, but, and you feel like such a lemon. Like, I've had it where, like, yeah, it cuts off. And like, and also you do have to power through, because you have to act like, you know, I'm like, oh, yeah, the camera and stuff.
Like total control.
Yes. Oh my God. And then I found, so I was trying to do regular Twitch streams, and I do think I will need to do it more, just because I have to accept that there will not be live performances for a long time, really. And that is heartbreaking. But so yeah. I've been thinking about it, but I did get sick of it, because it did feel a bit like two different a relationship to the one I'm used to and have built up skills for. So like on stage, I perform and I love the audience and we interact, but it's not constant interaction. And actually it felt a bit like I was hanging out with people who weren't my friends when I could just be hanging out with my friends. Do you know what I mean? It'd be like, yeah, I suppose you like biscuits as well, do you? Jeff Horn 3, great. Cool.
Would you, during a typical gig, pick in the audience a lot?
No, really not. Yeah, I'm definitely somebody who wants to like be friends with the crowd, like make them feel at ease, make them feel very safe. But then that is quite exhausting in a Zoom context, because really, really caring about the chat.
I know, well, that's it. Because I was going to say, I mean, it, that sort of banter that you could get away with of picking on someone in a crowd would be so much harder to do over Zoom.
Too brutal. Can you imagine? Just like, ouch. Yeah, it's so interesting. And it's something that, like, in the past, I haven't really had a good experience being a female comedian online. It's not fun, and as a result, like, I have all these like just like anxieties and desire, like it's not like oh great, I'll perform online and with joy in my heart I'll share. It's always like a little part of me is like, oh, the terrors of online. So oh, I'm trying to get over that.
Oh, well, I hope that it goes well for you anyway. And as you said, I just don't know how long we're going to be doing this for, you know, hopefully not too much longer before we can get back to the real live stuff. But Josie, what I would like to try and do maybe is go back to the early years, you know, because Broad Talent tends to work a lot with running community projects and projects in schools to try and promote creativity. So, and there's so much that you do that I would love to try and talk about for any listener who's also interested in going down that path. For you growing up in England, was there anyone, first of all, that from your area that you knew personally that you took inspiration from, or was there anyone on the TV or any female comedian that you wanted to sort of emulate, or you know, what are your memories growing up?
So when I was a kid, I used to do a kind of drama club, and there was a teacher there who was incredibly inspiring to me. Her name's Trisha. Trisha's drama club.
It was, and shout out to Trisha and the drama club.
Yeah, big shout out. Thank you very much. Trisha Elliott, it was called, but I think she has changed her surname actually now. So, you know, pointless, but let's be specific here. So, there was drama clubs and art clubs and things like that. I actually used to go on a very weird, hard to explain kind of sort of like a gifted and talented club, but it wasn't. It was also like just odd troublemaker kids as well. So it was like, I was like very much in the category of like, we guess you could be gifted or you keep annoying everyone. You can't decide. It was very much that.
What are the other?
It was like, whatever this is, it's too much. It was that sort of a club. And it was great. And there was a guy there called Jimmy Simons, who's an artist, and he would do a lot of really, really great workshops about kind of letting us be creative and showing us how we could open and unlock kind of creative writing, artistic workshops, that sort of thing.
So, I mean, for somebody who's going to go down the line of being a comedian, is school a brilliant place where you've got a constant audience in your peers, or is it this place that, I've often wondered about comedy and going down that line, that from a musician's point of view, there's so many things you can get involved with that music can sometimes just be a natural progression of things that you've gotten involved with in schools, be it bands or shows or whatever. You know, for comedy, are there many things that you can get involved with to make you think, this is what I want to do for the rest of my life?
Well, it's interesting because as you said that, I was really reminded that, like, actually people's classroom persona doesn't necessarily translate into them becoming a comedian. Like, you know, the person who might be the most like class clown doesn't necessarily actually want to pursue it. Like, it's very weird, like, because there are elements of it that are about writing or wanting to feel like you've got something to say or puzzles solving and stuff like that. So it's a really unusual type of personality type that's drawn to it. And also then it depends culturally what's going on, because I think different people are drawn to different aspects of it at different times as well. So, yeah. So there were things at school that I definitely see were a part of me wanting to be a comedian. Like, we used to do debate competitions and I would always try to do like funny debates. And the worst, the absolute worst. And we would do things like, we'd have like drama things and sketches, and we'd put on a lot of comedy stuff at school in a small way, like in assemblies or in like a drama thing. But I was very lucky because there was a stand-up comedy workshop near me, so that when I was like 14, I went on that, and it was for adults. It wasn't really for under 18. But what's amazing now is, like, there are lots of sort of comedy workshops and courses you can access quite easily, even if you are not yet an adult. Yeah, there's stuff online. People kind of do workshops and stuff like that. But it's interesting because it's also something that you can do, like with stand-up. You can do it on your own and you can learn it on your own. And now there's more opportunity than ever for kind of getting stuff out there and enjoying that. And I also think it's evolving. Like, I hate to sound like a 40-year-old woman talking about things I don't understand, but there are like loads of funny people on TikTok and they're doing stuff that's like completely in and of itself of a different form. And like that is a way to get yourself heard, and like, obviously YouTube and stuff in the past, that's been ways that people have done stuff.
It is so, something I think that isn't spoken a lot about is how social media and general technology and the access that younger children have to technology. I know obviously it brings about its own risks and complications, but it also brings about a much wider access to creativity, you know, whether it's recording or whether it's performing, or as you're talking about, you know, comedic elements as well to it, that it does give a platform that very recently wasn't available.
Yeah, that's true. And like, so when I was a teenager, we would make videos, but like, wouldn't even watch them. We're just there. You'd make a video with, I'm talking literally a video camera with a video. A video, great. We've made one video. We'll show it to four friends, you know. Or we'd make fanzines, and that's like limited. We used to do the photocopying at my friend's mum's work on the sly.
Did you charge people for them?
Depends. Just depends if they were cool, you know. Depends what's going on.
It depends how happy you were with them.
It's interesting. I think it's so complicated. Like, I keep thinking about Vine, which was a social media platform that ended about must have ended about 3 years ago. And it was really popular about 8 years ago, eight years ago. Does that sound right? Oh, God, who knows? It was popular for a time.
Yes,
it had its day. And it was taken from us too soon. But there was like this whole group of hilarious people on Vine. They were amazing. And they had so many followers. And there were people that I loved.
Yeah.
But they were always... remained. Like, there's a woman who was a supply teacher in Portland, and I now follow her on like Instagram just because I think she's a cool person. But she was like a Vine superstar. Then Vine closed, and she never made a living from it, and she was never able to kind of keep doing it. And so I do think the difference between social media stuff and maybe something that now, even though it's relatively new, feels more traditional, like stand-up comedy, is that the good thing about stand-up comedy is you can effectively build an audience that is real. I mean,
longevity is a really important part of it. Yeah,
just and money as well. Like,
well, true.
It's good to earn a living doing what you love. It's brilliant. Yeah.
I find that the more free stuff you put out, almost the more expectation that all the things you do has to be free then. You know, it's very difficult when you start throwing free stuff out there to then start charging people then to listen or watch the same thing that they could watch for free. So it's a difficult line to draw of trying to promote yourself, but also I need to earn a living from this.
And also not to throw away ideas and content, not necessarily throw away, but like burn. So if you think of a brilliant sketch and it's online, that is great. It will get viewed a lot. But you might not necessarily be able to like go and take that out and perform it lots, which may or may not matter to you. But like, I love the fact that when I write a show, I can tour it for a year and like enjoy performing it and like make it better and better and tinker with it and expand it and just really refine it. I love that. I love that it doesn't have to just be, excuse me, you did one stream, that was that, you know, or it came out as a tweet or a TikTok or whatever, and that was that.
Yeah, that's interesting. I know, because I'm always thinking, you're talking about comedy and I'm sort of translating it as music in my head, but it's very similar, you know. And even it's funny you're talking about this, because even in previous weeks on this podcast series, we've had other guests talk about similar things. And with Stuart Murdoch from Ben and Sebastian, we spoke about after a tour, sometimes you feel like you almost want to go back into the studio because you've just toured a song so many times. You now feel like it's taken this journey that, you know, so exactly, just when you're talking there about comedy as well, that shows evolve naturally and organically. And that's the best thing about live shows, is you won't get that experience on any other night you're doing it.
Totally. But then musicians, I think, are lucky because you can put out a recording of the song and still tour the song. And people don't go, we've heard this. Why would we watch this?
That's
people
true,
are like, yeah.
Yeah, that is very true, yeah. So you're talking about the access to getting involved in comedy growing up then, Josie. I mean, you know, this has also come from someone who won the BBC New Comedy Awards at aged 17. I mean, how did that come about?
So it was partly this workshop, because it was all adults on it. They really treated me like a little mascot, and they would put themselves what you'd call open spot tryout gigs, like 5-minute gigs. And they would always just be like, also, I have a teenage friend. Can they do it? So like, I would always go and gig with them like around London, and there were competitions. Like, that is a kind of established way in stand-up, is there are a few of these competitions. There's a student competition, there's So You Think Funny, I hope that's still going. There's a few comedy competitions, and people, anyone can apply. You go through it, you do heats, you do semis, you do finals, and like, they are really useful because people see you, and if you're good, people want to keep an eye on you. Like, what is lovely about stand-up is, I don't think if you're good, you will necessarily get everything you want, right? It's not like, if you're good, that's you. You're Chris Rock. That's not necessarily how it works. But I think if you work hard and you are good at it, you can make a living from it in some capacity. I really believe that. Or, well, there are some people who've been brilliant who've fallen by the wayside, but that's partly because it's a very weird life. And some people temperamentally are not suited to the weird life of being a comedian. And some people are. And so, some people are like, and this is a thing that I would genuinely say, if I'm thinking of what I would want to pass on to younger people, is if people ask me what I am, I would say I'm a comedian and I do some writing and some radio, or I just do anything, right? But in terms of creativity, it doesn't necessarily help to put yourself in a box and say, no, what I do is I'm this. Because actually, especially with something like comedy, that's very, very fluid. You know, you can write comic films, you can do stand-up, you can do sketches, you can do all kinds of things. But even within that, within stand-up, you can do stuff that's like massively experimental, prop-based, weird, or you can do stuff that's like so pared down, just very, very terse jokes. You know, you can do stuff that shares loads about who you are, you can do stuff that shares very little about who you are. And so I think it's really cool to sort of say to yourself, well, yeah, the aim is to try and generate some comedy, but I don't have to sit down and do a creative process that's like, okay, I'll sit at a laptop and generate some comedy, or, oh, you know, it's really cool to actually be like, I want to do some creative stuff where I have a lot of fun, you know, even when it comes down to things like making dumb craft stuff, making things for friends, even things like cooking, like anything that involves kind of a creative process, well, be it building something or thinking about things, entertaining ideas, mucking around, play is useful and will contribute to you as a creative artist. Like, I think a lot about how often in stand-up, I'm just trying to find a way to explain how I like to muck around with a friend, you know, I'm trying to share my internal comic world with other people. So actually, the more playful you are in your life, the better you'll be.
That'll be.
Yeah. So I've got a friend called David O'Doherty, who's one of the first comedians I actually really got friends with when I was 17. And he was 23, and he sadly lost the BBC New Comedy Awards to me. And he's never got over it ever. Because he shouldn't.
Just to bring that up.
It means forever that he's the inferior comedian, and I hope he hears this so much. What was so exciting was I met him, and he was somebody who really, really loves a game and a laugh and mucking around with his friends. He's such a playful person, and I think that has kept him such a good, consistent comedian over his life, because he's always got silly games on the go, be it like a fun word game or like just mucking about with pals and doing silly projects. And I often think, if you want to be a comedian, and this is advice I want to take myself, because honestly it's quite hard to do that sometimes under grim circumstances, but the more you can enjoy silly things, doing things for whimsical reasons, just not taking life too seriously, the more fun you will have on stage and the more material.
Are you saying it's like, instead of having the approach of I'm now on stage, I'm going to switch into comedy mode and tell funny stories and be a comedian, that it's almost you just need to be on stage how you are off stage?
Yeah, I think so. Well, it's complicated, because I'm always one for saying, don't shut yourself down in advance. Don't sort of say, no, I need to be doing this, that, the other, and that's the only way. Mm. But I do think, yeah, the closer you can be to who you are on stage, in my opinion, the better, more interesting comedian you'll be. And that does involve like getting to know really your sense of humour. Because I think, I've always thought actually that there's two types of comedians. There's people who think, what would the audience like? I'll try and do that. And they are terrible comedians. And then there's people who are like, what do I think is really funny? How can I best convey that? And those are people I think are good. Yeah. And so the more fun you have, the more fun you have to share. And the more you get to know that side of you, the better it is, I think.
So after you've won this award at 17, was that the point at which you thought, okay, that's my career that I want to go down? Was it beforehand? Like, was there ever a day that you woke up, or a pinpoint moment where you thought, this is what I want to do for the rest of my life?
Yeah, I think I was really young. I think I was about 12 or 13. I loved TV comedy.
Really?
Yeah, and I just really, really wanted to be a comedian, not necessarily stand up, like anything, like making a show.
So just involved in comedy.
In comedy,
that's amazing.
Yeah, and performing it. I really wanted to perform. Yes, I definitely have known since I was about 12. And I've never, ever doubted it. I doubted it maybe for a couple of months about a while ago, like when I was an adult. Once I was really in, I could have been a doctor. but I would have been a terrible doctor, really terrible. Absolutely awful.
But you're right, though, because there are so many ways. I think a lot of people pigeonhole themselves unnecessarily as well. You know, I was listening to this podcast a while ago where they were talking to, it was actually, they were talking to a doctor, and the doctor was saying that people think that the role of a doctor is only in a hospital, and or, you know, you might be able to set up your own practice and be a GP. But, you know, you can be one of these doctors that gives advice on radios. You can be a doctor that gives advice on TVs or in newspapers. And so, like, you can have that sort of social media side to your work as well. Mm. And I think that sort of manifests itself in a lot of different jobs, that it's not just...
Yeah.
There's no one I've spoken to so far that has only seen themselves as being an onstage comedian or an onstage performer, and that's all their work goes into, just what you see on stage. There's so many things that people are balancing behind the scenes as well that probably contribute, that definitely contribute to you know, their performance on stage as well.
Yeah, I agree with that. I do. And I think that what's been interesting is meeting people when I first started doing stand-up and then seeing over the past kind of 15, 20 years where different people have gone. And you do see that, you know, some people started with stand-up, kept it forever. Some people we knew as stand-ups now are like a very specific genre of TV writer or like make pop-up books. Like people still do creative careers, but they found things that suit them better and stuff. But also, yeah, it's funny because... yeah, you're never just doing the one thing. You really aren't. Yeah. You're always hustling loads of different things. You're always thinking about that. And I think that's why I say it's good to sort of keep open, because you might have an idea that doesn't work as stand-up and you don't want to then go, oh, it doesn't work. You go, okay, I'll keep that. What can I use it for? And even I've had it where years down the line, an idea has suddenly worked for something else or joined in on a part of Peter Brighting. But also, I do think... however, that if you really want to get somewhere in art, whatever that may mean to you, you know, whether it's going professional, whether it's certain gradients of success that you think are important or whatever,
yeah,
I do think at some point you probably do need an almost maniacal focus. Like when I first left uni and I went to just trying to perform stand-up and trying to go professional, I basically gigged 6.5 nights a week for like,
oh my god,
3 years. Yeah, I like didn't have a social life. I always was gigging, I was temping, and I just really, really, that's all I wanted, and I was obsessed with it. And I think sometimes there might be times when it might feel a bit full on, the amount of effort that you need to go to. Not always, and I'm not one of these people who's like hustle, like I think it's a delicate balance, but I do think that sometimes you need to be incredibly dedicated if you do really, really want it to be your life. Yeah.
And do you see then, Josie, whenever, because you've won so many awards throughout the years
not
as well.
Not for a long time, man. Really been a dry awards season for me of like, absolutely gutted. All I've won in the past little while is game shows. That's what I do now. I used to win comedy awards, now we're against it.
But that's what, you know, I was actually going to bring up the game shows as well. That when you were thrown into the celebrity status, or you know, brought onto Celebrity Island, or things, you know, is that in some way? I know people say, you know, don't read too much into these things, but in some form or deep down, is that some way of all of those nights that you're talking about, those 6.5 nights a week of gigging to try and make it in a career, when you're put onto the platform of being considered not just good at your job, but a celebrity in your job, you know, is there...
If I'm honest, it's the opposite. No one will book me for comedy stuff at the moment, so I'll take whatever I can get. So, no, it's very funny with stuff like that, because in some ways I think all of that stuff is just a silly distraction, and I like doing it because... I really like rich experiences in life. So I've done two big reality TV things for me. I did one where they drop you on an island with Bear Grylls and you have to survive. And spoiler alert, I survived. And then one where it's like Celebrity MasterChef, right? Now, both of those, the reason I did it is because as a layman, I would want to do that.
Yeah.
Like I'm not a real celebrity in the eyes of, like, I'm not from Towie, or like I'm not good value. Like I wouldn't look at a plate of eggs and be like, oh, that's cracking or something, like, you know, I wouldn't be able to do what they want. But I'm always very eager and very earnest, and I'm a very good mid to level background character. And what happens is I've now lived on a desert island for 3 weeks in Panama under the stars. That was like an incredible experience. And I've also like cooked a milfoy with a guy from Gogglebox. Like these are things that cannot be taken away from me. And the same with game shows. Like as a kid, I loved quiz shows so much. And so that is kind of an additional childhood dream to like randomly get to be on quiz shows. And won money for my charity as well, which is really good.
Well, this is a nice segue to talking about it, because you're not just somebody who talks about making a difference and using what you have to sort of try and help other people in their journeys and quests as well, but you actually have put your money where your mouth is as well, where you've set up Arts Emergency, which by all accounts seems like an absolutely amazing organization. Can you tell the listener a little bit about what Arts Emergency is all about and the kind of typical work that you do with that?
Yeah. I'm really, really proud to have like been involved with it. Like, I still am involved with it, but I now, thank God, they have so many members of staff who are so perfectly placed to run the organisation. So my friend Neil Griffiths and I set it up, and it took a while of it being just the two of us. And honestly, him doing a lot of the heavy lifting. He started out running a an activist group called No Sweat that kind of helped people who worked in sweatshops organize. Well, it helped raise money to basically send in solidarity to people who work in sweatshops who are organizing. It's just like a really cool organization that basically just connected radical struggles around the world and like help people fight to get better paying conditions. Oh man, he's an absolute hero. He's incredible. And then we both got to a point where we were kind of approaching 30, and we both really felt that we'd been very lucky to go from sort of what we would say perhaps like non-traditional or slightly complicated or unusual for university backgrounds, and to have like university educations that we were really proud of and had done a lot kind of change our lives. And so what we wanted to do was take that privilege we got and sort of pass it back as quickly as we could. And we initially, it was about, in reaction to 10 years ago, the coalition government in Westminster got rid of the grant that funded arts and humanities degrees completely. So they stealth privatized them, which has absolutely caused great problems down the line. And they also tripled tuition fees, obviously not in Scotland, but in England. And so we wanted to react to that. But the problem is we couldn't fundraise enough to make a dent in anything for people who are just thinking about trying to pay people's fees, this kind of thing. What we could do was, what we did realise was that it was a really strongly felt thing among a lot of artists and a lot of people in the arts and humanities. And so we realised that there were lots of people who desperately wanted to be useful and to give up their time and to share what they had with younger people to make their experience coming up easier, and who recognize that it's difficult times if you're not from money and you want to get into the arts in any capacity really, and wanted to make that easier for people. So then it gradually became this really, really big mentoring and support network for young people.
Amazing.
And they get involved. People get involved for years and they get really looked after, and like we see the most wonderful things as a result. Like people who didn't think that it was for them to like go and study what they wanted, studying what they want, getting a job in that field, or just people whose artistic practice is really enriched by it. And also the young people we work with are like phenomenal and always exciting and full of ideas and just brilliant people.
I love it. I really love it. And I think it's so important. In some ways, not to say that it's the same as what we're doing at all, but it's very similar to why we wanted to set that up. I think, you know, myself, Darren, and Lydia all had the same idea that, like that, we wanted to try and take whatever we'd learned to bring it to some areas that are kind of left behind a little bit, you know, where and all the stats showed year in, year out that people from less privileged backgrounds are astronomically less likely to end up in creative pathways. And it's such a shame that, and we've worked even in schools, I'll never forget one person in particular I won't mention, but, you know, an amazing musician, absolutely amazing musician in school. And, you know, I turned around and said, would you ever think about looking at the conservatoire, you know, and really taking it seriously? And he goes, oh, well, I don't think that's for me or people like me.
Oh,
and you're just,
God,
you're listening to that thinking, oh my God, like this is, there shouldn't be, you know, talent should speak for itself really. And everyone should have the same platform, you know? So I think what Arts Emergency are doing is really commendable. And
oh, thanks. I think so. I think it's more important than ever. Mm. Like, I think it's so frustrating to have the same little tiny segment of the most privileged people in society being told that they're the best and getting to live these lives, that actually it's just a massive waste that people who don't come from money or don't come from the industry or don't have any connections don't, you know, who are, it's not just as good, they're better.
And do you feel, was this something, if you don't mind me asking now, Josie, I don't want to be prying, but did you feel when you spoke about growing up in an area that, forget how you phrased it, for, you know, getting the university degree wasn't...
It's more complicated for me because my circumstances were that I had a bit of... I had a really... I had an unstable home life was my circumstance somewhat. So even though I actually went to a grammar school that was quite a crammer school, even though my mum... We did not have any money at all, but I did have this very privileged secondary school education. So my background was because of the kind of instability. But also it was a real culture shock to get there because I went to Oxford University and honestly, I had no idea that boarding schools existed. I had no idea about these. Well, I did, but you know what I mean? Not in any meaningful sense. I didn't understand about class or money or wealth or any of these things. And I was completely fish out of water. But I had the good fortune of getting into a grammar school. So I sort of, in some ways, I always feel really like I have to be very precise in qualifying my exact circumstances, just in case somebody's like, you said you were working class. And I'm like, no, I said it was lower middle class. It's different. But my friend Doug comes, not Doug, sorry. My friend Neil, he's just my other good friend. My friend Neil that I set up the... Basically, what I do is I like to find a good friend and create a thing with them. And it gives me accountability because they're a good person. And my friend Neil comes from the more non-traditional background in terms of attending university. And I think that makes sense. I mean, it's so weird. Every class, I think, in the UK is barely understood and often misappropriated to people or talked about in unhelpful ways.
So then in terms of working with, I mean, Josie, you're kind of a link with a lot of different guests that we've had on this series because you we spoke with Stuart Murdoch about God Help the Girl.
It's so exciting for me. What, it's like a complete and total dream to get to be a part of that.
I couldn't believe, I'm not going to lie, I put it back on before interviewing Stuart and because I had... For want of a better word, I'd stalked you online for a while when you'd agreed to do the interview. And I thought I was trying to find out as much as I could. And then I saw you in the movie. And I was like, I didn't know Josie was in God Help the Girl. And then
I was actually in two scenes, but they cut one. And I do worry that it was because of my substandard performance.
I'm sorry we didn't get a chance to ask Stuart. And then with our first guest, Doug King, is obviously a very close contact of yours. And that kind of ties in with the writing that you're talking about as well. You know, you've featured in movies like Super November, which Doug spoke about. But you've also written movies with Doug.
I wrote Super November.
Oh, sorry, you've written Super November as well. Sorry, And
No, I didn't mean to be like, is he saying he wrote it?
Doug said he wrote it.
He's in big trouble. Tell him to check IMDb.
and you know, Let's Go Swimming and Romance and Adventure as well. So, I mean, where did that connection start with Doug? And is that a very different type of working experience when you're designing a film then I'd imagine something like stand-up comedy, you're getting an instant reaction from an audience to see if things are going well or not. Is comedy very different when you don't have an audience?
I think so. The comedy writing process is definitely very much for me. I do a lot on stage. It really helps my brain to focus, to go on stage with ideas and to kind of bash them out and let my brain loves to like make connections in the moment under the pressure of the stage. So I just let it happen and I enjoy it. The writing of the film is slightly different. It's a case of like me and Doug sort of really, really mining an idea together, really, really talking about all the different things that relate to our lives and our kind of experiences and our thoughts about an issue or about kind of the subject theme. And then I go off and kind of get it on the page and get it done. And so it's a much longer process. But where it's similar is, and where I love, DIY filmmaking in particular, obviously it's a bit more work for Doug. So I can see why he wouldn't love it in the same way. Once we've put into place the process of we know we're shooting X date, the turnaround time is so fast for the script, it means that I have to get it done. And it gives me the kind of focus and the energy to really, really make sure that it's done. I think our next goal for it and what I would love would be to have money and funding to help develop something for a long time and have those deadlines come from external forces and not just from our own like gambling.
Yeah.
Of like, yeah, we've done this. We've got to do it. But I like the thing I really love about filmmaking that you don't get with stand-up is the collaborative elements of it. Like the crew, like the fact that each member of the crew adds so much to the script and the idea, and you know, the film is so much more than just the writer. You know, it's so much more. Like, I love the fact that once I've got the script, you hand it over to Doug and then he creates so much that like isn't necessarily on the page.
I know.
And, like, makes it so brilliant. And then production design and, you know, music and sound, there's so much added to it. And that is just a really thrilling experience.
It is amazing when you get a few creative heads together, to especially in different forms of creativity, to see the different approaches and angles that each mind takes.
Yeah, like different personality types is what I was going to say. Like, you know, our DOP is a very different personality type to me. And so he's able to, and same with Doug, they're both able to do things in a very precise technical manner that creates brilliant results in a way that my style is a lot more like, I'm here, bye. You know, it's like quite slapdash.
Yeah.
I just found out that I've got ADHD and it basically makes all of my life make sense. Yeah. And it makes sense as to why I've chosen, like when I've been successful in my work, it's because there's been big deadlines that I've either arbitrary put on or kind of put on myself. Yeah, it's really interesting.
Well, that is interesting because, and when you say it sort of makes sense, would you have, looking back then at your time in school or, you know, would you have found it very difficult to sit and focus and pay attention to the classroom?
Yeah.
Okay.
And like always, like even now, I'm like fidgeting the whole time. I did. And I found university really difficult because there wasn't very much structure. And I actually need a lot of imposed structure in order to get things done. It is stuff like that. I look back and I wish that I'd been able to been given Ritalin or something. I mean, I don't know what I would have been given because I just got the diagnosis, but I wish I could have been given something at the time. I bet it would have just smoothed me right out.
Yeah, but would have been the bellow.
It's interesting.
Yeah, that is interesting.
But it also is responsible for like being able to write on stage. I think that's part of my brain being the way it is. And,
of course, yeah. When you're looking back then, Josie, is there any, specifically with schools, was there anyone in school that when you were there served as a major influence for you, you know, or did anyone point you in a good direction?
Yeah, so I suppose in the school itself, I had a really caring English teacher who looked after me in a pastoral sense, and I had a really cool drama teacher as well, but I wasn't allowed to take drama A-level because my school was a bit academic and they didn't want anyone having fun. So I do remember kind of the art department. Again, I wasn't even allowed to do art GCSE, but like I remember those teachers being really cool and enjoying it a lot. But like I say, it was this teacher on this odd children's summer camp that really, really, I feel, changed my life meeting him, because it was just being shown that you could think in a manner that was creative, that you could say, okay, I've been told this, but I'm going to look here and do this. Oh, yeah. Okay, I can be playful with this. And it was almost like all these kind of walls around everything just melted away and you could feel that the possibilities to life were more exciting. And I think that's what I love about Arts Emergency as well, is like what we try and tell people. We've got this manifesto and a lot of that is saying, don't let other people limit what you think your life could be, what you think you could achieve, what you think you could make artistically.
Yeah.
Don't take other people's decisions as to what's realistic or what's appropriate necessarily to heart. Like there was a thing that I always wrote, which is you're allowed to use your imagination. And like, I used to really care about that because I grew up somewhere that was very like small C conservative. And it was very much the attitude of like, who do you think you are? Stop being weird. You can't, you know, that's not the way life is. You need to grow up and live in the real world.
Yeah.
And actually, you don't. Ha ha ha.
Joke's on them.
Yeah. Damn straight. Who's laughing now?
Josie, it's been an absolute pleasure. I think you've not only have you achieved so much, you give such good advice as well. You know, you really do.
Thanks.
And it's amazing to see again, that this is something that hasn't just fallen onto your doorstep, that you've actually really put in the hours and you've made this work, and you've from whether it was gigging 6.5 nights a week, as you were saying, or you know, doing stand up, as well as all the script writing you're doing for BBC Radio, or you know, working with Doug and movies. Like, you've done so much. Is there anything, when you look back, any highlights and anything that you haven't yet done that you hope you might be able to achieve?
Oh, there's so much I haven't done. It's a funny thing, because actually I think having a creative career in the long term is full of regrets and rejection and stuff like that. You like, I could list the amount of shows I've pitched that have been turned down, films I've pitched that have been turned down, films I've written that have gone nowhere. Like, it's full on. And that is always hard, because you sort of end up thinking, oh, if that had come off, this might have happened. And so as it stands, my ambitions do change all the time. I think sometimes I think I want something and then I don't, and blah, blah, blah. But I would love to do more writing in like writing rooms. I would love that, because it's so lonely in lockdown. Like, I just want to be with funny people having fun. And then I would love to, I mean, my big thing is I would love for me and Doug to be able to make a TV show and make a film. And
no way.
That was something that I feel we were getting really close to before the lockdown. So hopefully we keep plugging
watch
away
this space.
Yeah, that would be my
dream. That'd be great. Oh,
yeah.
That'd be brilliant.
Yeah, I would love it.
And final question then, before we let you return to your real life, but if you were talking to the 12-13-year-old Josie Long, and she's sitting,
I'd
there,
I'd say, don't have a centre parting, it's no good. You need a fringe, and you need to sweep it from one side. There's no need. To give her advice, I think I would say try not to take other people's opinions to heart at all. Try not to, especially, like, there are issues with regard to like abuse, but also with regard to like sexism and racism and homophobia in the world and in how artists are perceived. And so you do sometimes get like mean stuff coming to you, and what I guess I would say is, like, really, really ignore it. Like, don't even, like, not even pay lip service to it. I think the closest that people listening to this, what I would say is, if you feel you want to write stuff and share it and make stuff, try to keep this very, very pure desire of wanting to share your lovely things with the world in whatever they are, and try to keep as innocent as you are, with not second guessing yourself and not criticizing yourself and not taking other criticism to heart. Just try and just share. That's what I'd say.
Oh, what a great note to leave it on. Josie Long, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure having you on the Creative Podcast.
Oh, thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Well, I really hope you've enjoyed this episode 4 of our Create Podcast first season. From all of us here at Broad Talent, we would like to say a massive, massive thanks to Josie for joining our podcast today and taking the time out to chat. We will be releasing an episode every Thursday between now and Christmas, and you can listen to this on Spotify, Apple, Google, Amazon, and all of the other usual platforms. If you like our content, please subscribe to the Broad Talent channel on any of those podcasts and platforms, and help share the episode across your social media. As always, please tag us in your comments so we can hear your feedback, or email us directly at hello@broadtalent.org. Join us next week on Thursday, 26th of November, as we chat with lead singer from The Script and former judge from The Voice UK, Danny O'Donoghue, which we are all really, really, really excited about. So we'll hopefully see you all then.